Support for podcasts of Medical Monday comes from Vassar Brothers Medical Center, the only hospital between Yonkers and Canada offering Makoplasty, the newest robotic surgical system for hip replacement and partial knee resurfacing. health-quest.org/VBMCortho.
Oh, hello once again and welcome back to the Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us on this Medical Monday to discuss mental health and substance abuse issues is the wonderful, and I do mean that, Dr. Jennifer Michaels, Medical Director of the Breen Center, Berkshire County's largest community mental health agency. Dr. Michaels is also Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at the University of Massachusetts. She's board certified in both general and addiction psychiatry and has been in practice for over 15 years. She is employed, of course, at the Berkshire Medical Center, David Phelps, proprietor.
That is correct.
Yeah, David.
Yes,
Phelps.
And
we
happy
love
to be
him.
There.
He's our pal. Okay. So, Jennifer, Dr. Michaels, welcome back to Medical Monday. Okay, so let's talk about addiction for just a couple of moments. 1-800-348-2551. Why do people get addicted?
Great question, Alan. Well, there are many factors. We know that it's actually a disease that starts in childhood or adolescence, that young people begin to experiment, and some of them are genetically predisposed.
When you say genetically predisposed, their parents may have done it.
And so let's put it this way. Let's say both of us are 13. Wouldn't that be nice?
Sure.
And I have a type of gene that makes me feel really good when I drink alcohol. So my first time I drink alcohol, I'm much more likely to continue.
Right.
You have a different kind of gene.
Yeah, so I have acid reflux gene.
You have you drink and you say, I'm never doing that again, blech. And so you are not genetically vulnerable. I am very vulnerable. So that's one reason people drink. And then the other one is if mom and dad and brother and sister all use, I'm more likely to use.
Yeah, so it's nature or nurture.
It's both. You know, you get it both ways. Yeah.
I just saw our engineer, Zach, throw up his hands in the air, and I wondered if I had done something wrong. No, he says. Okay. I just wondered.
Oh, they're talking.
Yeah, okay.
That's a male dominance pose, by
male
the way.
Dominance
that's
when you
male
put,
dominance.
When you put your hands up in the air like that, palms outward, that's male dominance?
Male dominance. Your testosterone level is going up, and your cortisol level is going down. So there you go.
Wow.
Yeah, did you know that?
No, I did not. I learned some. Okay. That's why you're assistant professor of psychiatry, because you can teach me that kind of thing. That's great stuff. Okay, so let's go on. So that's why some people get addicted and not. Is there an economic basis for addiction, do you think?
Do you mean that
if poorer people are more likely to get addicted than wealthier people?
Yeah, we know that if there's deprivation, if there's trauma, that someone is more likely to get addicted. So it's true that very indigent people are more likely to suffer from addiction.
Yeah. And so addictions can be anything. They can be food, right?
Yes. We were just should we talk about
sure,
that?
Sure, yeah.
That, well, you were talking about food addiction.
I love food.
And that you may have a little dose of that.
Yeah. Well, I don't know how little. But all I know is I'm on the Weight Watchers, and I've lost all this weight. My sugar numbers have gone down, and my weight has gone down, and I don't have acid reflux at all during that time. So there's a pretty good idea for why to become unaddicted to food. Now, can I have all the things I've ever wanted ad nauseum? Can I have duck? No. Can I?
Is that on Weight Watchers? There must be a recipe.
Well, it's on it. You can have duck on Weight Watchers, but you use all your points, and you know that's not really the way. Or can I have things like pork chops or steak? The answer is they're high in points, so I don't have them. Mm-hmm. But I do have things that are really disgusting, like, for example, an acorn squash, a big acorn squash. You cut it in half, you make both halves. Do you know how many points in that?
No, how many points?
No is right. 0 points.
Oh, you just have to eat it, though.
You have to eat it. So you take a couple of chancy mistakes, like you put a couple of raisins in there with a little water. Uh-huh. Now, raisins cost you. I don't remember exactly how much. They could cost you a point or two. Yeah. 1-800-348-2551. Join the discussion, everybody, because we really want to hear from you. So Jennifer, there's a huge problem in Massachusetts now, isn't there?
There is a huge problem. And actually, Patrick, our governor, just called a state of emergency in Massachusetts because We're seeing an epidemic of young people overdosing, dying from heroin and opiate pills.
What is that about? Why heroin got cheaper all of a sudden?
Well, this is what happened. Doctors were responsible for over-prescribing opiate pills. We had this directive to manage all pain, treat people for pain, give them opiate pills. And we got so good at it that we ended up having a lot of people addicted.
You said we have this directive. Who is the directive from?
From various federal organizations.
From the head guys.
The head guys. The people who talk about pain management, pain is the fifth vital sign, when it really isn't a vital sign. A vital sign is something we measure, like your pulse or your temperature. We can't really do that with pain. Right. But anyway, about 10, 15 years ago, doctors began to get a strong message, treat pain and use opiates. And so doctors did and flooded the country with opiate pills.
And then people began to sell the opiate pills and all the rest.
And get addicted and die, overdose and die. And now we're pulling back. We're learning that that's not a good idea.
Yeah.
And what's happening is we're seeing that people are addicted to opiates. They have diminished access and they're now seeking heroin because that's just another opiate, but it's illegal.
Wow. So, and heroin is easier to get than the opiates?
Depending on your location, it's cheaper.
Yeah.
And it's also much more potent, so you need less of it to get high. Mm. When you first start to use it, you can use it intranasally. As you build up a tolerance, you end up needing to inject it, and then it gets that much more dangerous.
Let's go to Jamie in Woodstock. All right, Jamie, you're on.
Hi, Alan. Hi, Doctor. How are you doing today?
Hi.
My question is about the treatment modalities for alcoholism. I know that AA has worked wonders for a lot of people, but I also know that there are some questions regarding its efficacy. And I also heard there was a guest on a radio station not too long ago who was talking about some different treatment modalities for alcohol abuse that sounds like they were a little more behavior-oriented. And I was just wondering a little bit about the specifics of some of these alternative modalities versus the AA model, and also if there are any modalities out there that stress self-control and moderation over complete and total abstinence from alcohol.
Okay, so good questions, I'll say. There has been work looking at controlled drinking. So this would mean someone who had out-of-control drinking, trying to educate them so that they could have just one or two beers or glasses of wine a day. And it's been shown that that doesn't work. The person may have some control for a week or two or a month or two, but they revert back to their set point. So the ideal is not to have controlled drinking, to stop drinking. That's the idea.
Now, what about Jamie's very good question, though, about the efficacy of the 12-step programs?
So let's talk about that. That's a good question. 12-step programs are ubiquitous. They're free. They're spiritual. It gives a severe alcoholic a sense of belonging and hope, and there's a sponsor who's the role model. It seems to work better for the more severe alcoholics, and that's great when it works, but we need alternatives, and people should be able to look at their options. Rational recovery is another treatment. That's applying more of a behavioral approach. And then there's...
Is it a cognitive behavioral therapy kind of approach?
It has more of that, a looking at your triggers and relapse prevention.
So for those of us who are a little bit deficient in our nomenclature, cognitive in this case means...
Cognitive means thinking, the way you're thinking.
Okay.
And learning to identify faulty thinking and developing some rational responses to your faulty thinking.
Uh-huh.
Like, I'll give you an example. Maybe I'll have a hard day at work today and I'll drive home and I'll feel like, oh, I'm so stressed. The only thing that will help me is a glass of wine.
Right.
So I'm going to become cognizant, aware of my faulty thinking, and then I'm going to develop alternative ways of coping with that stress.
That's so interesting. You know, I sort of developed years ago the Chartok theory of character versus maturity. Character is when somebody really likes to walk down the street, sees dog poo, and steps in it. But he's addicted to stepping in dog poo. But then one day he really realizes this isn't good for me. So as soon as he approaches the dog poo, a light comes on in his head saying, no, you want to do it, but don't do it. Is that
exactly
sort of what you're talking about?
Yeah. That is the parallel program. The dog poo or cognitive.
Except dog food. Yeah. Dog food doesn't have the rewards that that drinking does.
Well, for some people, that's easy for you to say, Jamie. But there are obviously dog poo people out there.
Yes. Yes.
I'm wondering, Doctor, if there has been any study that indicates that just in whole. I know you said that AA tends to work for the severe alcoholic better. Are there numbers that indicate that just overall percentage-wise, whether or not the behavioral models and the cognitive models are more effective in general than the AA models, in spite of the whatever kind of problem drinker you're looking at?
I would refer you to Project Match, MATCH, which compared different therapies, and they all work. The good news is they all work. There's also one more motivational enhancement therapy, and they all work for people. So it's not like one is the answer.
Yeah. Hey, listen, Jamie, I'm so sorry, but we got to let you go. We are about to take a little break, and I loved your question, so I appreciate your calling. I hope you'll call again. Thanks again.
Thank you.
1-800-348-2551.
Support comes from Premier Medical Group, gastroenterology, urology, internal medicine, endocrinology, geriatrics, nephrology, and pulmonology, with offices throughout the Hudson Valley. PremierMedicalHV.com. Mount St. Mary College in Newburgh, Master's in Online RN to BS in Nursing Degree Programs for Adult Students, Postmaster's Nurse Practitioner Certificates in Adult and Family Health, msmc.edu. College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair services and 24-hour towing and recovery service for over 30 years, collegestreetmotors.com. And Marriott Townplace Suites, Albany Downtown, offering studio, 1- and 2-bedroom suites with fully equipped kitchens. Amenities include indoor pool, breakfast, local transportation, Wi-Fi, and parking. PPSAlbany.com for reservations.
We are here with the wonderful Dr. Jennifer Michaels. She is one of the great experts on addiction. And she is medical director of the Breen Center, Berkshire County's largest community mental health center. She is employed by the Berkshire Medical Center. Dave Phelps,
our leader.
He's a wonderful guy. Okay, so Jennifer, I guess I want to talk to you a little bit about exchanges of addictions. So somebody gets addicted to alcohol or to marijuana even. Do people who have addictive personalities change addictions? Can they? In other words, go from one to another?
Yes, and I think that's more the rule than the exceptions.
Really?
So we treat a lot of people with addictions, and they do wonderful work, and then we find out they're addicted to scratch tickets or online pornography, that it's just the way it goes. They don't want to stop smoking.
Do they have guilt about any of this stuff? In other words, people who are addicted, I've often wondered, they know they shouldn't be putting heroin in their arm. Obviously, on some level, they know that. Or they know they shouldn't be watching porno because it's bad for family life. Or they know one of those things. So do they feel guilty when they do it?
I think it's a combination of guilt and shame, and it isolates them, and a sense of powerlessness. It's inevitable.
Okay, so we got a very good question from Casey. We're going to go to her now because she's asking a question which is terrific about medications. I love this question. Okay, Casey, ask it.
Hello. Hi, Casey.
Yeah, go ahead and ask the question, Casey. It's a great question.
Well, I had taken Ambien for a very short period of time.
Now, that's a sleep medicine, right?
Yes.
It is. And
it's supposedly not addictive, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
And maybe it's me now that I just heard what you had previously said about an addictive personality, but I really felt myself being addicted to this little half a pill I would take, really every night for about 3 months. And I didn't like myself. I felt some kind of grogginess the next day, like maybe even missing a word in a sentence where normally I don't usually miss any words. Then I quit it. I just cold turkey. I said, I can't do this anymore.
Well, first of all, Casey, you did quit it. But I want to get...
Oh,
yeah. It's a great...
And it wasn't easy.
Yeah. It's a great question. I want Dr. Michaels to answer it. You know, these things come advertised as non-addictive. But if our personality is such that, you know, we convince ourselves we can't go to sleep without it, then it becomes addictive, doesn't it?
You're exactly right. And so we see doctors innocently prescribing medications such as Ambien or Soma or Tramadol that some people can take and not get addicted to. But if you're vulnerable to addiction, you have no business taking it. And we need to educate our patients about this.
Yeah. So Casey, you're brilliant. That was a great and incisive question. We appreciate your call because it cleared a lot up.
Thank you.
Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Dr. Chartok. Bye-bye now. Thank you.
Let's go to Jim in Matamoros, Pennsylvania, 1-800-348-2551. Your chances of getting in right now are excellent. Go, Jim. Jim. Oops. Got to press the button. Okay. Jim, you're on. Go ahead. Sorry.
Are there personality types such as obsessive-compulsive or manic depressant that may be less likely to become addictive?
Interesting. Less likely. So we know that if you have a mental illness in general, if you're manic depressive, if you have obsessive compulsive disorder, anxiety disorders, you're more likely to struggle with a co-occurring addiction. So in some studies looking at bipolar disorder, more than 50% of the people also had addiction.
So co-occurring is such an interesting word. It means that at the same time you have the other problem, you are basically more likely, right, to be addictive, become addictive. Yeah.
Well, it's kind of, we know that co-occurring illnesses happen. If we think about if you're obese, you're more likely to be diabetic. If you're hypertensive, you're more likely to have other diseases. And so, you know, they kind of jumble on top of each other. And the same thing is true for mental illness.
Wow. So, wow. Jim, anything else on that?
Guess not.
Well, thank you for the call, as always, Jim. Appreciate it very much. And how are things in Matamoros?
Well, a little bit windy today.
Yeah, here too, and up in the far north of Albany.
Yeah.
Thanks,
yes.
Jim. Appreciate it.
Welcome.
Okay. 1-800-348-2551. 1-800-348-2551. I'm fascinated by what you just said, Jen. The idea that, okay, we do know there's an absolute correlation between being obese and getting diabetes. Now, not for everybody, but your chances are much greater for that. You know, frankly, after, not that anybody wants to know about my issues, but once I went on...
Everyone wants to
lost,
know, come
and,
on.
And lost 12 pounds or 13 pounds, my sugar numbers went down. Way down.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this thing, and sometimes we listened, and sometimes we don't. That's one of the things we have. So let's go to Ted in Shelburne. Okay, Ted, you're on.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
I have been interested in something that I think is related to this topic for a long time, and it's sort of, how about the environment of people who become addicted and even with mental health become, you know, more and more hopelessly depressed, something like that. And something that has intrigued me, and I believe it because I see the research on it, is a program called Roots of Empathy, which is best understood by looking at rootsofempathy.org. And I'll just quickly say the research component, because it's actually under on their homepage, what we do, and go to the research that's under that column instead of straight to the research. And then after you read that, which is easy, click on the report from 2009. Anyhow, it explains an environmental, like it's a serious piece of curriculum that goes into elementary schools, and it shows a great deal of improvement that can be maybe summed up as developing and being in a nurturing environment, as opposed to a lot of what we may be coming across, especially these days with video games and, you know, whatever, the way the world has changed, that, you know, stronger family would be great, religion would be great, but it's not exactly clicking, and this thing that works in schools can be good. So I'm interested in what you think the environmental component of more or less addiction, more or less likely to become addicted.
Okay, sure. Here we go.
Okay,
thank you very much.
Thank you,
stay
Ted.
On.
Yeah. Thank
I'll
you.
Stay.
So we know environment is so vital to the path a young person takes, and that's really the target, young people, because that's when addiction starts in the teens. And so, for example, the United Way in Berkshire County has done work with young people, educating them, preventing the onset of the addiction, and also educating their parents, teaching them that the social norm is not to throw parties with alcohol, but the social norm is to throw parties with fun things to do other than substances. So as a community and a culture, we can shift the culture, as we've done before. If you think about safety belts with education and laws, we changed our whole attitude about that. Same thing for smoking. We used to have about half the nation smoking. Now it's down to less than 20%. So environment and the messages.
It'll cost you 10 years in your life.
It does, yes. And I would love to help anyone who wants to stop smoking to stop smoking. We have the best treatment ever.
We have some people here I want to send to you. Yeah,
I know. I'd like to lock them up in the back room and then do some mandatory treatment.
Yeah, okay.
And doing these things early, I mean, when you think of it in a mechanical or some other sense of doing the orientation and rather than doing the repairs after the failures.
Yes, and so prevention is key. We call it prevention, early intervention, and we're focused on that. Many communities are creating coalitions to do that because we realize treatment works, but we'd like to prevent the need for treatment.
But you know, Ted gives us a very interesting word, environment. Now, there are schools which are nurturing. Mm-hmm. They are rather strict sometimes in terms of, you know, what colors you draw with. There's things like that, but they're loving. Everybody
yes.
has a smile on their face. So, but sometimes they get addictive personalities in there who become addicted. So the definition for me, Ted, the big problem is the definition of environment.
Well, I did want to use that word, and I think it's true, in the environment in which we grow and learn. I mean, when you see kids, you know, I just love seeing 10, 11, 12-year-old kids who are in a learning and caring and happy sort of environment. And because this Roots of Empathy has some research, and because it's a couple hours a week, I think, in elementary school through at least a semester, that they have figured away, and it's pretty clever in this Mary
Well, I
Gordon.
Love it. I love it, but if your mother is sticking a needle in her arm,
well,
and
yeah.
you
I mean,
see that, that's not
check
that's
it
not
out.
2 hours
you
a week.
Might,
yeah.
You might be able to help your mother.
But Alan brings up
if
a great
you're
point.
A smart kid.
Alan brings up an excellent point, which is that the messages we give our kids creates the environment that either promotes use or minimizes use. And so, it's not just the school. It's the parents. It's the
At
friends.
At 2 age 4. You know, Freud had it all, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm sorry.
But the school is a workable culture. That's,
yeah, it is.
That's my point.
No, I'm not denying that.
Yeah.
So,
I appreciate this conversation because I've sort of been, I noticed this on Canadian television, kind of fuzzy at my house more than 10 years ago as they were putting it into Montreal schools.
Well,
and I've, you know, it just makes so much sense, and I sort of keep saying it to people in leadership, and they keep working on repairing the damage.
hey, Ted, it's a great call.
Thank you so much
for making
Appreciate it.
Appreciate it. Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, let's go to Robert in Northampton. Okay, Robert, you're on.
Hi. I just was wondering if chocolate could be addictive and also snacking.
The bad news is, yes, they can be addictive. And when we look at brain scans of people who are addicted to substances like heroin or cocaine or marijuana or alcohol, if we look at foodies who eat compulsively in an addictive way,
yeah, me too.
Their brains look just like people addicted to other substances.
Yeah.
So food can be addictive. It's how you eat it. You're more likely to get addicted to simple carbohydrates. I call them the white foods. And you need a rainbow of colors to avoid that compulsive eating of snacks and chocolate and things like that.
So, Robert, my question to you is, when do you eat?
Oh, I have snacks in the car when I'm driving. Yeah. I have snacks in the office.
Yeah. Because, you know, I sympathize with this because, you know, I see food, I want it. And it doesn't matter if it's mealtime or any other time. So I'm a potential addict, you know, in terms of food.
We would say in remission.
So,
remission.
I would think so, but now I'm addicted to things like No Points acorn squash.
The tough thing about food is you have to eat. You know, if you're addicted to substances, you don't have to drink, you don't have to use cocaine. You do have to eat, so you need to create a diet that is anti-addictive.
But when you look in the refrigerator compulsively and you see nothing, but you're always opening up the refrigerator to look and see what's in there,
yes,
as opposed to just eating at mealtime. You know, that may tell you something about yourself, doesn't it?
Oh, I think so. And then you would need some...
acorn squash.
Or cognitive behavioral therapy, or what was the other therapy?
Yeah,
the dog poop therapy.
Therapy,
one of those two.
Robert, thank you for the great call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go to Sarah. 1-800-348-2551. Sarah in East Nassau. Go.
Hi, Dr. Chartok. My son has mental health issues and was diagnosed about 2 years ago and was put on the first of many antipsychotropic drugs. And the sad news is that the side effects, he's been on two or three different ones, is a tremendous weight gain. And in 20 months, he put on over 100 pounds.
Wow.
My question is there any progress being made with having these drugs somehow more streamlined where that is not the side effect? Because he's now on metformin, a diabetic medicine, to take once a day in order to keep him from becoming diabetic. And his body, I just think it's going to explode. There's no more room for any more weight. Mm-hmm. His mental health issues have abated somewhat, but he can't live without them, and they're lowering the dose slowly. But he'll never be without them, and I just don't understand how a person can carry around that much more weight and not have self-esteem issues and this just domino effect of a lot of other things that affect them.
Sarah, great question. And I think, sadly, your son's experience illustrates the challenges of treating someone with a mental illness, because some medications do cause weight gain and some can cause a lot of weight gain. Sometimes what we will do is transfer someone suffering from weight gain to something that's less likely to cause weight gain. I don't know if that's...
He's on Zyprexa now.
Uh-huh.
He had started off with... Seroquel, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the other names, but he's balancing it out with a little Wellbutrin, and this is not without constant dialogue about nutrition, but the antipsychotropic drugs cause carb binges,
yes,
where it's almost like he's an eating machine and he can't stop himself. So unless he's 23 years old, so unless I'm seeing him do it and saying, you can make another choice here, let's have something else, there's some fruit here, have more water, drink water before you eat, just some kind of suggestion. If I'm not there, he's in school now. We finally, after 2 years, he's trying to finish up his degree, but he's not here. I have no idea what he's going to put himself through just to get through the semester.
So I would recommend that you talk to his doctors about looking at a different medication that has a better profile in the weight gain area, because some of them are just as good as an antipsychotic but less likely to cause weight gain.
Okay. All right.
Sarah,
thanks
for the call.
Sure.
Appreciate
you. Bye-bye.
Best of luck.
Okay, let's go to David in Poughkeepsie. David.
Yes, hi. My question is in reference to, I know this socioeconomic point of that everyone seems to be talking about. But on the other side, I don't think a lot of people are pointing out how addiction is affecting a lot of the suburban middle-class and upper-middle-class neighborhoods. Can you give some information on that?
Well, yes. We are talking about the risk factor. If someone's in poverty, they have a greater risk for developing a substance use disorder. But what we're seeing now is that there's an epidemic of opiate misuse, and that knows no boundaries. You know, it doesn't matter if you're rich or poor or somewhere in between. We're seeing people overdosing and dying from heroin. There was a—I don't know if you saw this, Al, on the front page of the New York Times a couple of weeks ago—a young woman who overdosed. And we know in Massachusetts we've had close to 200 overdoses in a short period of time, and it doesn't matter what side of the tracks you come from. You know, everyone is suffering.
Yeah. David, thank you.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to Sally and Clifton. No, Sally, you stay right there. We have to take a short break. We'll be right back. Stay right on the phone.
Okay. Support comes from New York Oncology Hematology for more than 30 years providing comprehensive cancer care in your community. With locations in Albany, Latham, Troy, Rexford, Amsterdam, and Hudson, NewYorkOncology.com. HMT at the Spa Little Theater, presenting Boeing Boeing by Mark Camaletti, weekends April 18th through May 4th in the Saratoga Spa State Park, homemadetheater.org. St. Mary's Healthcare, Amsterdam, New York, offering minimally invasive spine surgery, choose stmarys.com. And Adelphi University Hudson Valley Center's Graduate Social Work Program and Graduate and Undergraduate Nursing Programs, hosting an open house Saturday, April 12th, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. St. Francis Hospital Medical Arts Pavilion, adelphi.edu.
And we are back. Terrific. I love talking to Jennifer Michaels, our wonderful guest, who is the medical director of the Breen Center, Berkshire County's largest community mental health agency, and also works for the great Berkshire Medical Center, David Phelps, proprietor. Okay, what were you going to say, Jen? Anything? No, you won't.
I forgot.
Oh, no, we got Sally on the phone. All right, Sally, you there?
Yes, I am.
Oh, great. What do you got?
I was wondering if the doctor could speak a little more towards the issue of adolescence and substance abuse and it developing in adolescence. And if an adolescent can stay clear of any kind of substance abuse or alcohol or any of that through their adolescence and into adulthood, are they less likely to develop an addiction later on? If they're, I'm making the argument to my teenagers.
Sure.
Is that a valid argument to make? If you can just stay clean until you're out of your adolescent years, then you may not be as more prone to addiction.
You have it 100% right, Sally. So the way it works is if you start using early, you are much more likely to get addicted. For example, if you smoke marijuana and you're 12 or 13, you have about an 18% chance of becoming addicted to marijuana. If you can wait until you're in your early 20s to try marijuana, it goes down to the low digits, like 3 or 4%.
Okay.
And the national average is about 9% of people who experiment with marijuana become addicted. So true for all substances.
Yeah, but I want to get you into trouble, Jen, but let's try.
Okay, try to get me into trouble.
Marijuana, there's been a great debate. Right now we're on the downside in which people are saying, okay, let's make sure that people who are medically in need or dying or have major diseases, okay. But also there are people who are saying, let's legalize it altogether. But by the basis of what you've just said, it's almost as if you say that anybody can use it, that you're asking for more addiction.
Well, what I'm saying is teens are vulnerable. And if we as a country decide let's legalize it, let's not legalize it for teens. And let's give them a clear message that it's not great to be using as a
teen.
Like
smoking.
Yeah. I'm a physician, I'm not a lawyer, but I would say our nation has to decide what to do about legalization. As far as our teenagers, though, we want to protect their brains. The earlier they're exposed to any substance, whether it's alcohol, marijuana, opiate pills, the more likely they will wire their brain for addiction. If we can delay any exposure to the 20s, their brains will be healthier.
Well, Sally, you sure seem to have gotten it right on, and we appreciate it.
Could I ask one more follow-up?
Of course.
If they are just, trying something one or two times, does that open the door, or does it have to be more use than that? You have kids making mistakes.
We're going to use our good judgment. So for example, if somebody, as part of a custom, maybe a religious custom, has wine at a temple on a Friday night.
Or peyote.
This one is a troublemaker today. or tried something once, are they doomed to a life of addiction? No, absolutely not.
But are they more likely? I mean, think of all the people who had sex the first time.
They're all having sex.
Do they ever say,
now.
Oh, that? Okay, I'm never doing that again.
See where that got you. No. But
he is causing trouble.
He is in trouble. He's in big trouble. But if we look at a pattern of use, that's what we're concerned about, a pattern of use. And what happens is that becomes the new norm, so that all of the other good, enriching activities become kind of peripheral for this person. They cease to create reward because a substance is the reward. So once or twice, is the person doomed? Absolutely not.
But are they more likely with once or twice than if they never did it?
We don't have that data. I mean, ideally, the message to tell your child is, I don't want you using. These are the reasons why. I want your brain to be healthy. The earlier you start experimenting, the more likely you'll have a problem.
Yeah,
if they used once, does that mean, oh, all right, forget it, kid. You know, you're stuck and you're an addict? No.
Okay. Hey, Sally, thanks for the great call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to David in Kingston. David, you're on.
Yeah, hi. I just would like to talk a little bit about, I wouldn't call it an addiction, but maybe a dependence on over-the-counter nasal sprays. I know it says to take every 12 hours, which I do. It says not to exceed, I think, 3 or 4 days, which I definitely have. It seems like it's really the only way I can clear my sinuses at night to get to sleep. Is this something bad or something I should worry about or something I should try to wean off?
Well, David, I don't want you to worry, but I want you to pay attention to it, because over time you build up a tolerance to nasal spray, and it will clear your passages. And then if you continue to use it, you will become almost dependent on it. You will need it to clear up your passages.
Okay.
So it don't worry about it. Just I would consider seeing your doctor and talking about it, looking at alternatives, and then you have to wean yourself off and be on something that's not going to cause the same problem.
Okay. What type of procedure would it be to wean off this? Just curious, what are the options?
Well, I would do it under a doctor's care, so I'd follow up with your doctor. But it usually involves lowering the frequency and the amount, and then having a safe alternative available.
Okay.
Hey, David, have you gone to a sleep center to be analyzed for, overnight apnea or something like that?
No, it's not a sleep problem at all. It's just I am uncomfortable breathing through my mouth, and my sinuses are just totally clogged at night.
Sure.
So if I can just get, if I use the nasal spray, it clears it enough so I can get to sleep, and usually I'm fine. After that, I'm fine. I'm fine during the day, and it just seems to be at night. And like I said, I started what I thought had a cold. I don't know if it's allergies or what now, but it seems like over the past month or so, it's been really the only thing that helps me get to sleep.
David, we thank you for your call. You got so many people behind. We're trying to get them all in. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Right.
Bye-bye.
Okay, let's go to Caroline in Sharon, Connecticut. Okay, go.
Hi, Alan. I have a suggestion about... you're looking longingly at the refrigerator.
Sure.
I don't know if that's right after you've eaten a meal.
Oh, yeah, all the time. I walk by, I'm bored. I just look in the refrigerator.
Well, I work at home. I'm an older woman, and after years and years of feeding a family and a husband, I now am usually, I'll be with friends sometimes, but I usually eat alone. It's taken a while to adjusting to meals for basically one person.
Yeah, that's fine.
But I find that I don't worry about, does this have a little fat in it? I've heard these reports just in the last couple of days that some fat in the diet is important, and it does give a lot of satiety. I've also heard...
Wait. What's satiety?
Satiety, satisfaction.
Oh, okay.
And that... you know what the apostat is?
No.
The apostat is your brain telling your stomach, thank you, I've had an elegant sufficiency, as they said in the old polite days. I've heard it as elephant sufficiency.
Okay, so
what
are you really saying here? Because we got a lot of people behind you, but what are you really saying?
What I'm saying is, one thing that I find very helpful, I just happen to be a very slow eater.
Oh, boy.
It takes 20 minutes, they say, for the apostat to kick in.
Yeah.
And if I want a little ice cream, I have it.
But my father-in-law, may his memory rest. You know, he was following this guru who believed that every single piece of food should be chewed, I think, 36 times. So by the time we were done with the meal, he was still on the salad. It's enough to drive you right out of your gourd.
Well, you know, if I'm in a restaurant with friends and I do that, I take half of it home and eat it the next
day. That's a
day,
good idea.
And I do feel that if you enjoy food and don't worry about it too much, and if you have a balance, obviously vegetables, fruit, you know, the things
that
you know are good.
Yeah, but you're not addicted. That's the whole point. We're talking about here about all those people who are addicted. You sound like a very balanced...
I do think, though, that eating slowly, enjoying it, not worrying about it too much can cut down what you may think is a serious addiction and find out that it goes away.
That's true. Carolyn, I may be kidding with you, but I really appreciate your call. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to Walt in Vermont. Okay, Walt, you're on.
Hey, yeah. You guys been talking a lot about the environmental factors and how that might influence addiction.
Yeah.
But I was curious as to what extent, like, if you do genomes and how much genetics actually has impact on the addictions.
Good question, Walt. And we've done a lot of those studies, and we see that your risk of developing an addiction is 3 or 4 times greater if your parents have addiction. So it is a genetically related disease and also has environmental influences. So does that mean that if your parents are addicts or alcoholics, you're destined to be alcoholic or an addict? No, it just means that you're a greater risk. And that group of people, we really want to prevent the initial exposure, because if they start early, you know, it's almost a fait accompli that they'll develop the disease.
Walt, thank you. I'm trying to get everybody in. Appreciate it.
Okay.
Right, let's go to Lee in Ulster. Okay, Lee, it's got to be fast. Go ahead.
Alan, stress. Is it possible that a person who is not necessarily an addictive personality goes through a period of serious, really serious stress and is more inclined? And if you treat the stress, do you treat the ability of, do you help people deal with an addiction or a potential for addiction?
Okay, great question. Jennifer?
So you may be someone who has no predisposition for addiction, but you're stressed every single day. And then one of those days you drink alcohol because you just happen to, and then you realize, oh, I feel less stress. So you may actually learn with that behavior that when you drink, you treat your stress. And that's how addiction can manifest. There are plenty of people I treat who never had an addiction problem. And because of an environmental issue or too much stress, they're now addicted. And so treatment is dealing with the addiction and also stress management.
So does stress management, can it precede an ability to handle a predisposition to be addicted to something that you wouldn't have before?
So you mean if you are a very stressed out person, does it make you vulnerable to addiction?
If she treats the stress, will she be able to handle the
potential for addiction?
It will be part. Right. It will be part of the treatment to prevent addiction. You know, once somebody is actually addicted, stress reduction would be one facet of treatment. It wouldn't completely resolve the addiction issue, because what happens with addiction is your brain gets wired to have an expectation for a substance.
So serotonin uptake, that kind of thing, might help her.
Well, you're saying, well, that's a medication that is used for depression, but I think it's looking at the whole person at that point, not just stress reduction.
Thank you very much.
And Lee, thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Okay, let's go to Patricia in Guilderland. Patricia, go. 1-800-348-2551. Go, Patricia.
Yes, I'm eating a lot of carrots and feel like 5 or 7 a day and feel like really called to do it. And
Are you turning orange?
Yes, I have had some orange on my hands. To get off it, I started eating some rice cakes, but that isn't so good either with the carbohydrates. And
yeah,
I,
but low in points.
Low in points?
Yeah, Weight Watcher points. Yeah, go ahead.
So what about, you know, I can get up in the night and want a carrot. I mean, it's that bad.
Well, I think, are you eating other things? Is it a balanced
diet?
Oh, yes.
I eat very well. My diet is immaculate, except for eating too many carrots and now some rice cakes.
Yeah, I used to juice with carrots. No kidding. And I did start to turn orange.
Do you turn orange? Yeah, yeah. Alan's not just talking about your hands, but the chemicals.
Face.
Yeah.
Face can turn orange.
Yeah. Have you turned orange? Has your face orange?
It has maybe a little bit of color, or did, and then I get off it for a while.
Okay.
Okay.
Rice cake. Rice cake addiction is a better one. Hey, Patricia, thanks for calling. Although carrots have no points.
Well, cool. Everything in moderation. That's what I say.
Aristotle. You and Aristotle. And Roselle. Thank you. Bye. Okay. Let's go to Mike in Saratoga Springs. Okay. Go ahead, Mike.
Oh, great. Thanks for taking my call. I'll be real quick. I was just curious. You mentioned earlier about the addiction more likely in low-income bracket. I was wondering, has there ever been any long-term studies, particularly with diet and particularly sugar with children leading to addiction?
Interesting.
You know, I haven't seen those studies. They may exist, and I think I'm going to go back to my office and do a little research.
Homework.
Yeah, I have some homework.
I see a lot of the children who are not fed well, particularly eating a lot of sugar, seem to have short attention span and develop the characteristics that I think would later lead to addiction.
I'll sum up my theory. Sugar, bad.
Yep.
Right. Yes.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it. Oh, go ahead.
Oh, just one thing. We know with adults who eat a lot of sugar that their brains are... their brains are comparable to people who are addicted to other substances. So I consider
sugar a substance, a drug. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
Thanks, Jen. David in Greenwich. Okay, David in Greenwich, you're on.
Yes. I'm listening to your conversation today. I developed an idea that I wonder if anybody looked at. About like a childhood. When I was a kid, there was a family that smoked cigarettes a lot.
Right.
Ear infection. Nobody knew about this. And what it was attributed to the smoking. Smoking contributed to that. But might it be that being exposed to the nicotine at such an early age and such a consistent level may have put me towards being an addictive personality?
Well, if your parents smoked, your chances of smoking are much greater. My father smoked, but he was a hidden smoker. He'd go in the bathroom, open the window, and smoke.
Oh.
But we didn't.
Did you ever smoke? No.
No. I tried cigars at one point when I was a young assistant professor trying to show off.
The look.
And the stuff just came back. Well, it was Columbo, but the stuff came back at me in the middle of the night, and that was the end of that.
Okay. So if
not the nature of my question. I was totally repulsed by cigarettes mostly, and I was worked for most of addictive realities. But when you said that there are people who eat sugars and this and that, they show the same thing as nicotine or the same thing as heroin in the brain and this and that. I started to wonder if you're exposed to nicotine at an early age, might that do something to predispose you, warp your brain to the potential where you later on want?
You mean secondary smoke, for example?
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of that in the house of it.
Okay, so secondhand smoke means that you're a child in a house and the parents are smoking. We know less about addiction in that child due to the secondhand smoke. We know more about if your parents smoked, you have inherited a risk for smoking because of the genetics of addiction. We don't know.
I'm just drawing a correlation. I heard an idea that if you're exposed to secondhand smoke and nicotine on a consistent level, from your earliest birth, might that do something to your brain, do some of your physiology that later on you may have addictive tendencies away from smoking?
Right, and we don't yet know enough about that. We know that there's an association with asthma and some other medical issues. We don't know the answer to your question, but a good question that you brought up.
David,
thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Okay, let's go to Larry in Red Hook. Larry, we're running out of time. Very quickly.
Hello.
Hello, very quickly.
Yeah. Is there a direct link between habitual marijuana smoking and lung cancer?
No, not at all. There is a link between or a correlation between regular marijuana use and things like bronchitis or airway disease, but not lung cancer.
Okay.
Thanks, Larry. Okay, we'll go to Abby in Catskill real fast. Abby, we're running out of time. Help. Go ahead.
Hi, Ab. My name is Abby. I'm from Catskill, and I just wanted to say I'm a 49-year-old recovering alcoholic.
Congratulations. That's wonderful.
And I just wanted to say that I never knew that alcoholism ran in my family. And for any parent that has any genetic disposition in their family, if they could tell their children at an early age. I wish that my parents had or my grandparents had told me.
How'd you find out really quickly?
I found out when I went to rehab in my 30s.
And how did you know that they were?
I finally confronted my parents in my 30s.
Okay.
Huh.
But I wish that they had told me earlier.
Okay. Listen, I'm so sorry, Abby. We are out of time, but that's a great suggestion. We appreciate it very much.
Great. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Have a good day.
We are out of time now. Thanks for everybody who called. Appreciate it. Jenny Michaels, Dr. Jennifer Michaels of the Breen Center for being with us today. Thank you so much, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Always
I
a great
it.
Pleasure to have you here.
Great to be here.
Support for Medical Monday comes from Toprasin, creams designed to heal muscle aches, back, neck, and shoulder pain, injuries, and carpal tunnel, and more. Toprasin.com. And thanks to our engineer, the always attentive Zach Malloy. Thanks to Colleen O'Connell Esquire for answering the phones. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Alan Chartok. Thanks again for joining us on the Vox Pop. Remember, the conversation continues online at wmc.org/VoxPop. On tomorrow's program, an open forum. Stay tuned now for a news update.